Hello and welcome to the Health Foundations podcast. I'm Jennifer Dixon, Chief Executive of the Health Foundation. In this podcast, we look at the most important issues affecting the future of health and care for the people in the UK. And we discuss these with very interesting guests. Today, we're focusing on Glasgow. Why is that? Well, if you think of health in the UK as a fabric, it is the most threadbare in Glasgow. Here, life expectancy is lowest, and one in four men will die before their 65th birthday. We all know about the widening health gap between rich and poor in the UK, particularly in the under 65s. But even after adjusting for poverty and deprivation, next to comparable deindustrialised cities such as Liverpool and Manchester, Glaswegians have a higher risk of dying prematurely than anywhere else in the UK. That's from cancer, heart disease, stroke, as well as the so-called deaths of despair from suicide, drugs and alcohol. It isn't getting any better, and that's not even taking into account the pandemic. One resident remarked, "We die young here, but you just take the hand that life deals you and get on with it." So we're exploring today, what is fraying health to this remarkable degree in Glasgow? What's being done to help? And as we across the UK attempt to build back better and level up, what can we all learn from Glasgow's long-standing efforts to try to mend the health fabric? With me today to discuss all this, I'm truly delighted to introduce two people who have for many years been central to this story. Dr. David Walsh is Honorary Senior Lecturer at the University of Glasgow and a Senior Academic at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. Over the years, David has carried out a lot of careful work to understand Scotland's and Glasgow's high levels of excess mortality. He's also researched deindustrialisation and health across European regions and the impact of the government's austerity measures on mortality. And also Sir Harry Burns, who is the Professor of Global Public Health, University of Strathclyde. Harry was the Chief Medical Officer for Scotland for almost 10 years, from 2005 to 2014, and he's well known for his tireless work on health inequalities. He's a member of the Council of Economic Advisers in Scotland, and he's also a local boy. He went to school and then medical school in Glasgow. Well, welcome to you both. Let's start off with a few, just paint a picture for us, David, with some of the stats. Can you tell us a little bit more about what we know about the trends of health in Glasgow and perhaps relative to Scotland and the UK as a whole?
It's no secret, as you've alluded to, that health in Glasgow is poor relative to other urban areas, both in the UK and actually across large parts of Europe. A huge part of that relates to poverty. You know, poverty is the biggest driver of poor health in any society, as you know, be that in Glasgow, be that in Scotland, be that in the UK, or be that in Europe. And related to that is the sheer scale of inequalities, of health inequalities in Glasgow. From the data we've got, I'd be reasonably confident in saying that health inequalities in Glasgow are wider than in any other European city. So there are clearly things that are very different about Glasgow compared to other parts of the UK. But I'd also say there are a lot of things that are similar. You know, inequalities, extensive inequalities, are a characteristic of all parts of the UK. And we know the reasons for that, because since the late 1970s, early 1980s, there's been a dramatic transformation in levels of inequality across all of the UK. So Glasgow's are wider, though. And also the changes that we've seen in mortality since the early 2010s, from around 2011, 2012, have been pretty catastrophic. You know, so female mortality rates in Glasgow have not changed in 10 years. And that's a dramatic statistic when you look at the previous decades of improvement. But that overall, what's been referred to as a stalling of improvement, is actually masking increasing death rates among the poorest in society. But that is not specific to Glasgow. We are seeing that in all parts of the UK, and they're clearly linked to the UK government's austerity measures, which has impacted on the most vulnerable and poor in society. Male life expectancy in Glasgow is roughly around 74 years, which is 4 years below Scotland, about three less than Liverpool and Manchester, about five less than places like Bristol and Sheffield down south. So yes, overall male life expectancy may be around 60 to 73 years, but that will range in areas of Glasgow from about 83 in the more affluent parts to down to about 65 in the more deprived areas.
Thank you. And can you say something about the gap between
socioeconomic quintiles over the last 10 years or so. Do I understand it right that it is widening and it's the gains in increasing life expectancy are just not being felt in the most impoverished communities?
So again, I'd like to emphasise this isn't just about Glasgow. This is about the whole of the UK. We've done a study which looked at Scotland as a whole, England and Wales as a whole, Northern Ireland, and then a whole number of UK cities. So what we're seeing is actually a different type of inequality developing. So historically, what we've seen are widening inequalities because although the health of the poorest was improving, it was improving more slowly than the health of the more affluent. So you get this relative gap. But actually what's happened in the last decade is that the health of the poorest, and if we can define that in different ways, but the 20% most deprived of any of these cities, the 20% most deprived of England and Wales, of Scotland, has actually started to go up. People in the more deprived areas of the whole of the UK are actually dying in increasing numbers. I don't quite know if people out there really get this, but it's a staggering change. I mean, in a really wealthy country like the UK.
What sort of conditions are driving that?
Well, there's been all sorts of work done internationally and within the UK, and although there's still a lot of conversation about it, it seems reasonably clear that this is about the effects of the UK government's austerity measures. You know, they have slashed £47 billion off the social security budget alone in the UK. Who is affected by that? It's the poorest. It's the most vulnerable. Social security is there to be a safety net to help people in times of difficulty, and that's been taken away.
Harry, we interviewed Angus Deaton on a previous podcast, and he did point to austerity being one of the reasons for fraying the health fabric in the population in the UK. But he was also very strong on the longer run economic changes, structural economic changes that he said had crushed communities, certainly in the US that they were documenting. So I wondered whether, on top of what David just said, you might either comment on what David had to say, but also tell us a little bit about what's been happening, particularly in Glasgow. Why is Glasgow so different?
So my interest in this area goes back to the time when I was a surgeon. My first career in medicine, I was a surgeon, a consultant surgeon at the Royal Infirmary in Glasgow for 5 years. And the Royal Infirmary in the east end of the city had the most deprived population coming into it. And I was particularly struck by the interactions I had with people who were, for example, coming in with serious alcohol-related problems, acute pancreatitis and so on. And you would see people coming in 3 or 4 times with acute pancreatitis, which is sometimes fatal on the first go. But I remember a conversation with one where I said to him, look, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And the response was, I know I'm going to die, but I don't care because life is crap. The booze is the only pleasure I've got in life. And that story in various forms kept coming back to me. And that's what prompted me to give up surgery and to go into public health to try and understand what was going on. Doctors are taught about disease and the causes of disease. What I realized in my public health training was that it was well-being and the causes of well-being we needed to focus on more. David's report on the Glasgow effect, the comparison between Glasgow and Liverpool and Manchester, was a real blockbuster. You know, the assumption up until then had been that poverty and so on influenced the same population, different populations in the same way. Something had happened in Glasgow that made it worse. And looking back at the history of Glasgow, you know, post-war, Glasgow began to spiral downwards in the sense that it began to lose a lot of jobs. Men who had worked all their lives in jobs that gave them a sense of status in the shipyards, for example, those jobs just disappeared. And the other thing that was happening in Glasgow at the same time was a complete change in the social structure of the city. The city engineer at that time decided that he was going to knock down all the old traditional communities and he was going to build high-rise flats. So people who were able to look to their neighbours for support and tenements and so on, which were not the most salubrious bits of accommodation by any means, suddenly found themselves being taken away from those houses, taken away from their friends, decanted into temporary accommodation while high-rise flats. So the communities were broken up. The friends that folk had for years that they could rely on for a bit of support and advice and so on, suddenly they saw them no longer. There were no mobile phones in those days. So the communities were broken up and the jobs disappeared and people were left feeling helpless. Helplessness, poverty, and so on came together to create this huge gulf in self-esteem and self-control between rich and poor in the city.
And how has that affected life expectancy?
The gap in life expectancy has widened dramatically since the 1950s.
And how different is Glasgow from Liverpool and Manchester?
When David published his paper on Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester, the first person I spoke to was a colleague who was director of public health in Liverpool at the time. And I asked her, why is Liverpool different from Glasgow? Why you guys had the Toxteth riots and so on. We've never had riots in Glasgow. Maybe if we had, it would be different. And her take on post-Toxteth Liverpool was the city council went out of its way to try and create stronger communities. So I think we can see ways out of this for Glasgow, but it will take a lot of political determination to do so.
David, Harry was just describing the differences that might be existing between Glasgow and the health of the population in other deindustrialised cities, Manchester and Liverpool, and I know you did some very detailed work on this. Can you chart what you think are the major differences that could be contributing to the difference in health between these cities?
The paper Harry mentioned came out about 10 years ago, which showed that Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester were very similarly deprived cities using the kind of area-based measures of deprivation that we have. And despite that, and actually that they were similar in lots of different ways, but despite that, that Glasgow's health was, you know, far, far worse. So premature mortality at that time was about 30% higher than in Liverpool and Manchester, despite these similar socioeconomic profiles. So that spurned a lot of conversations of the type that Harry's just described, and a lot of speculation, some of which was quite helpful and some of it which wasn't very helpful. So everyone had their own pet theories about what was going on. So to try and bring some resolution to this, we embarked on a very large piece of work in which we systematically and scientifically examined no fewer than 40 proposed theories for what was different about Glasgow that was contributing to its higher mortality. And what emerged from that was a very complicated story, but at its heart was a toxic combination of worse living conditions historically and a lot of really bad political decision-making at different levels of government. And if you go back to that post-war era, and indeed if you look at across a number of decades of the latter half of the 20th century, if you use measures of low income, then Glasgow, Liverpool and Manchester, their poverty levels seemed quite similar. But actually, in those post-war decades, the actual housing conditions in Glasgow were miles worse. In part response to that is some of the stuff that Harry touched on in terms of the changes that were made to the city in those post-war decades, which had a much worse effect than they did in our comparator cities of Liverpool and Manchester. So the slum clearance that Harry mentioned in terms of how that broke up existing communities is highly relevant. In terms of the building of really poor quality peripheral housing estates, this happened in lots of cities in the UK, but it was done on a much larger scale in Glasgow. There's lots of evidence of negative impacts of that type of high-rise living on mental health, and we know about links between mental health and physical health. But on top of all that, fundamentally, was at key points in time, they actually just invested less money in looking after these properties. We then had additional disadvantage conferred in the city at that time by actions of the UK government, or to be more precise, the Scottish Office. They instead embarked on a whole series of policies that you can only really describe as sort of writing off the city, as kind of giving up on the city. So Glasgow was officially declined to be a declining city, and all economic investment was to be made away from the city, not in the city. And as part of that, industry was moved away. When they built the new towns to deal with the housing shortage, not anyone could move to a new town like they could in the new towns built around Liverpool. There was a selection process in operation. So they targeted people who had jobs, who had skills, who had trades. They were particularly interested in younger families with children. And then another Scottish Office report, and this is the Scottish Office who were actually doing these, implementing these actions, they referred to the fact that this was a huge concern because we were creating a population in Glasgow that was basically old, unemployable and sick. So a completely vulnerable population. But despite knowing that, they kept doing these policies for a number of decades. And just to finish this kind of very quick run through the story, you know, it wasn't that put Glasgow at a disadvantage. It wasn't one single thing. It's a whole lot of different things. And by the time we got to the 1980s, when we had the Conservative Party in power in London, Mrs. Thatcher in charge of that, embarking a number of policies that were widening inequalities and having a big effect on post-industrial or soon-to-be post-industrial cities like Manchester and Liverpool and Glasgow, there were different actions taken by local governments in the different cities. And as Harry alluded to, there were actions taken in Liverpool which better protected the population. So what was going on at that time resulted in a much more politically engaged population. And in contrast, in Glasgow in the 1980s, there was a different thing going on. There was a kind of business-led model of regeneration which focused on regenerating the city centre, for example. It's been a whole cycle of problematic factors conferred on Glasgow.
Exactly. I mean, that's an absolutely fascinating story, David. And I think that account, I mean, partly written very fully in your 2016 report from the Glasgow Centre, I absolutely recommend. It's called History, Politics and Vulnerability, Explaining Excess Mortality in Scotland and Glasgow. It's absolutely compelling reading. And I think it's really very relevant now to our, you know, as we attempt to level up across the country, if that indeed is a serious strategy, to learn from the decades of what has happened in Glasgow, even though it was quite unique, is going to be absolutely important. So a lot of factors, deep structural factors, as well as the austerity that you mentioned earlier, David and Harry. I think what might be useful now is just to turn to the types of solutions that have been tried. I think looking at the various Scottish documents, what's absolutely clear is over the last 20 years, there's been enormous commitment and concern about these issues, not just in Glasgow, but across Scotland as a whole, to address inequalities since 1999. And I know that, Harry, you as CMO in Scotland were central to a lot of this because you were in post during a lot of that period where indeed Scottish government instituted its first reducing inequalities in health policy. Can you just chart for us, Harry, in Scotland, the key kinds of attempts and policies over the last 20 years to try to do something about these long-run issues, long and short-run issues?
So part of the problem in dealing with inequalities is an oversimplistic analysis of the causes. The outcome that any society has or delivers is based on a complex interaction of things. And we've already talked about housing, jobs, support in all sorts of ways. Part of the difficulty I think every country has had is that the politicians want to do a thing. You know, we now have the answer to obesity and inequalities in obesity is to ban advertising of fat containing foods in the evening and all this kind of stuff. That's grossly oversimplistic. The Adverse Childhood Experiences study in America started off as a weight reduction clinic. And it's very plain that adversity in families and in early life and so on creates a sort of metabolic response that leads to all sorts of health problems in later life. So you're not going to defeat obesity by just having an obesity policy. It has to be a person-supporting policy. Various things like banning smoking in public places in Scotland, taxing alcohol-containing drinks and so on. they have had an effect. But interestingly, the effect is often not what you would expect because it's a complex system. For example, I remember when we were talking about banning smoking in pubs, member of the licensed trade said to me, oh, you'll just harm children with that because people will buy carry out and they'll go home and they'll sit at home and they'll smoke and the children will suffer. In fact, it was completely the other way around. There was a significant reduction in admissions of children with asthmatic attacks after we had banned smoking in public places. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Boston had done their patient safety program, the 100,000 lives campaign. And we introduced this, and it was a way of improving complex system dynamics. What I've been talking about over the past year or two is we should have an inequalities improvement collaborative. And that the answer to improving things is do it from the bottom up. Don't tell people who already feel hopeless and not in control of their lives, don't tell them to do things. Ask them what they need to live better lives. And there have been lots and lots of projects in England, interestingly, that have worked that way. The Beacon and Old Hill project in Falmouth, where the place was a war zone, and Hazel Stutley and co. went out and asked people what would make a difference to their lives, and they helped them achieve it. Stoke-on-Trent did a similar approach, and they saw huge reductions in demand for social services, for healthcare services and so on, simply by identifying people that were living really pretty chaotic lives and supporting them. You know, we need, as part of support, to improve the well-being of people by making sure they have enough money to live on. And the behaviour of politicians over the £20 food for children stuff was again scandalous. We need to make sure that we deal with poverty, but we also need to make sure that we support people in achieving aims and aspirations and show them that they can be more in control of their lives. That will make a difference.
Yeah. Just to backtrack a minute, Harry, I noticed in amongst the many 20 years of initiatives in Scotland, which are impressive, a notable one was something that we're calling for in England at the moment, which is a cross-government strategy to reduce inequalities in health. And in 2008, of course, there was a ministerial task force set up by the Scottish government called Equally Well, which was really about across a serious attempt to reduce inequalities. And so can you just chart out that, what did this Equally Well policy try to do, and has it been successful?
I don't know what happened to Equally Well. It's gone. You know, no one talks about it anymore. I mean, if you leave things in the hands of politicians rather than frontline workers, then when the politicians change, when their attention is drawn elsewhere, the impetus behind policies will slow down and, you know, nothing will happen. It's got to be the frontline staff who are dealing with the difficulties every day that come up with the solutions, implement them, and you will get change happening.
Yeah, my understanding is, this may not be yet official, but my understanding is that there's a new strategy going to come out from the Scottish Government. But I think there's a bigger issue here in terms of, you know, if we're talking about the impacts of austerity, if we're talking about excess mortality, they're all forms of health inequality. So the first question is, do we know what works in addressing health inequality? And the answer to that is yes, because there have been all sorts of policy reviews. There was one a few years ago by NHS Health Scotland, which has now become Public Health Scotland. And they outlined very, very clearly and very effectively the policies that work, the policies that don't work, and what, therefore, we need to do. And in terms of what we need to do, fundamentally, it's about what are the fundamental causes of health inequalities. And we know from all the evidence that they are socioeconomic. So it's all about actions around trying to narrow income inequalities, socioeconomic inequalities. There's also actions you can do around more environmental things in terms of some of the stuff that Harry mentioned, like alcohol, air pollution, these things. But there's, when it comes to the question of Scotland, there's a big elephant in the room here, which is about Scotland talks about trying to narrow health inequalities. We have an economic strategy at the heart of government, which is about trying to narrow economic inequalities, and that would, you know, have an impact on health inequalities. But the big question is, do we, in the current devolved situation, actually have the powers to address effectively health inequalities and socioeconomic inequalities? There's lots of things that we can do, but if you look, for example, at, I don't know, the increase in work poverty, for example, over the last few years, linked to, you know, the zero-hour contracts, the gig economy, et cetera, et cetera. Changes to that requires changes to employment law, and that is reserved to the UK government. Scotland can't do very much around that. If you look at the scandalous changes to social security, which, as we've discussed, has impacted so much on the poorest, Scotland has minuscule powers over social security. So there's a big, big question about, although the Scottish government talks really admirably about the need to address inequalities, but the big question is, you know, are the powers at their disposal sufficient to address socioeconomic inequalities and therefore health inequalities?
I agree 100% with that, David. I think you're right. If Scotland is going to make a difference, it's got to have the powers to do so.
There have been positive developments. So, you know, as part of the package of austerity, people in England and Wales were subject to the so-called bedroom tax, and that was mitigated in Scotland by basically prepaying people with additional housing grants. They've just brought in a Scottish child payment, which is basically an additional low-income benefit for low-income families, and that's going to be doubled to £20 a week, I think, in the next Parliament. So there are things happening, but the problem is it's a balance about what powers we have in Scotland to address these issues that are massively outweighed by the powers we don't have, which have such an effect on them when they're used in the way they've been used by the UK government recently.
Inequalities policy review document that was in June 2013 from NHS Health Scotland, the key components of the health inequality strategy and what, you know, how to mitigate them were grouped into fundamental causes that do look like UK government in the bailiwick of the UK government. But then there are wider environmental influences of the type you mentioned, David, which look a lot to do with the powers that the Scottish government have, and then individual experiences, for example, you know, focusing on young children in early years and so on, which equitable experience of public services that look very local. Sure, it sounds as though there's significant power in the hands of the UK government, but there's also significant power locally.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, really helpful things have been done, and the breakdown of sort of policy interventions you've mentioned there sound very similar to the ones in the Health Scotland report I mentioned before around what works best around inequalities. I was talking to a colleague recently, and he put it this way, that if you kind of imagine a kind of set of scales, you know, in terms of Scottish government powers versus UK government powers, so there's all these really helpful things we can do and have done, lots of the good things happening. But the problem is that they are currently outweighed by the powers that are reserved to the UK government, because that's when we start talking about, you know, what have been referred to correctly as the fundamental causes of health inequalities being socioeconomic. So all the economic levers, social security, etc., they've had the biggest, they can have the biggest impact and do have the biggest impact. And the example of austerity and what happens if you slash social security is a great example of, you can do all the great things you like in one place, but if somewhere else completely removes the safety net and removes the income of the poorest, causing more and more people to die, then that clearly outbalances the good things that we've been trying to do.
For sure. So turning to the post-pandemic situation, where all the language at least is of build back better, to recover from the pandemic, everyone's consciousness is seared about the sort of distribution of hurt caused by the pandemic, both economically and health-wise. And given all the policies that have been tried in Scotland and effort over the last 20 years, I guess the basic question there is, where do you go from here, particularly in Scotland, to start off with? Harry, you are advising the Scottish government. It sounds as though there is going to be a refreshed health inequality strategy. What can be different about this? What should it be doing, learning from the last 20 years, do you think, to take us forwards?
My argument would be that we make change, we create change from the bottom up. Policy should be permissive. It should allow local agencies to support people in the way that they, the people themselves, find helpful. The whole idea of asking people what matters to them, what is it they need, has come out of all the successful projects that I know. The 100,000 Homes campaign in America, where they set out to use this technique to get rough sleepers into permanent accommodation. I went over to visit them, and they said that the thing that really made change happen was talking to the individual and finding out what had happened to them and helping support them to take control over their lives and do that on an individual basis. We need to do that, young people and who are experiencing domestic violence and all this kind of thing. But we also need to create the policies that will support the change from happening. And that is largely about making sure that there's jobs for them, making sure that those jobs are well paid, making sure that schools and so on give young people a sense of achievement and self-esteem and so on. So I would hope that the politicians, the SNP, who have provided over the improvement science approach that we've used in early years and in patient safety and so on, would want to have an inequalities collaborative that spanned the whole of society from the bottom up. Over the past few years, we've been talking to Scottish Government about the wellbeing economy, an economy that works for everyone and which allows people to be engaged. My hope is that the wellbeing economy idea will create, after we come out of this pandemic, will create momentum towards a better economic relationship with people who are more in control of their lives and who want to achieve better things in their lives.
And are you saying, Harry, that how would that come about, this grassroots starting from the people? Would it be through councils? Would it be through the third sector? What would have to change?
It's all of these things. When we did the Early Years Collaborative, every 5 or 6 months, we would get about 800 people in a very, very large room. And sitting round the table for each county and each health board, there would be local councillors, there would be local clinicians, there would be police, there would be social workers and so on from that area. And they would sit and they would hear what other areas were doing. They would see what was working. They would share ideas. They would test interventions and so on. And we began, you know, Scotland started that with the highest infant mortality of the four UK countries and ended up with the lowest infant mortality of the four UK countries. That's just one example. So it's about bringing people together.
Thank you so much. So, David, your take on this, the next steps forward, would be very helpful on top of what Harry has to say. Do you agree? Grassroots support?
What's become an almost hackneyed phrase is that the pandemic has shone a light on existing inequalities. If it's shone a light on inequalities, then we need to address those inequalities. What we're seeing from the data at the moment is, you know, we're going to have an impact on mortality rates or life expectancy from 2020 and in 2021, and then we'll go back to previous levels. My real concern is what those previous levels are, because they weren't improving, and for some of the population, they're getting worse. So what do we do? So we need somehow to try and get the UK government to reverse some of the cuts they've made to help people. The fact that they're not going to continue this £20 universal credit uplift is despicable, frankly. we need the Scottish Government to do everything they can with their more limited powers to try and help those people that have been affected by these cuts. And we have to think about, as I've said before, those fundamental socioeconomic causes of health inequalities. The Scottish Government's economic recovery plan is really ambitious, and like a lot of the documents the Scottish Government produces, it's really helpful and it's really positive and it's talking about doing all the right things. I just worry personally about, as I said in the last bit of conversation, about whether we actually have sufficient powers to do all the things that, that we need to do and that clearly the government wants to do. So I think another part of it, and I've heard some MSPs talk about this, you know, advocating to get additional powers around employment law, for example, to try and address some of these issues, including some of the things that Harry mentioned, are really, really important. Because otherwise, you know, it's fighting a really difficult battle.
So a great deal for us all still to do. I'd like to thank our two guests, David Walsh and Harry Burns, for what I think you'll agree was a great dissection of the issues, as well as some ways forward. You'll notice we didn't discuss the scourge of drug deaths in Glasgow, which is contributing to the higher mortality there, and that's because we'll be devoting an entire pod to drugs in the future. For links to key reading on the things we did discuss today, as ever, please find them in our show notes wherever you find this podcast. And next month, we'll be looking at an everyday substance that deeply affects our health, food. We are what we eat. How can our approach to food boost the UK's health, be good for the environment, and most importantly, taste good? I hope that whets your appetite. And thanks for listening, and see you next time.